You're listening to Nick Treadwell's Storyville. If I Was a Blackbird, Remembering Childhood TV, written in 2010 and revised and expanded in 2023. Somewhere in a box hidden away at the back of a cupboard, there's a collection of old VHS tapes. If you were to play one of them, you might see a somewhat spotty teenager clad in khaki slacks, sporting a well-worn homemade knitted jumper, smiling gleefully to himself, and the imagined millions watching through the lens of the video camera, perched precariously on top of the tripod in front of him. The said teenager would open his mouth and announce in a highly Americanized Texan drawl, "Hi, y'all. My name is Mickey Guitar Edwards II. And then proceed to launch into an introductory monologue about how he was some big-shot songwriter from across the pond who was destined for stardom. He then proceeded to pick up his acoustic guitar and attempt to sing his brand new opus, which leaned heavily on the chord of G, the lyrics of which went something like, "If I was a blackbird, I'd probably fly about, eat some worms, then eat some more worms and, well, and so on, as I'm sure you can imagine." It was 1987, and Mickey Guitar Edwards was in fact an invention of my own making. I was, at the time, it has to be said, bored, frustrated, and as mad as a hatter. As were most teenagers, in fact. But how I dealt with the challenges of my teens was, I suppose, for anyone looking in, a little peculiar to say the least. I was in the process of buying the guitar from my mum's Kay's catalogue for 50 pence a week, and had worked out that at some time during 1992, I might actually own the thing outright. For months, I'd been trying to learn how to play it, and my fingertips were both sore and raw from the fingering of chords to leaving on a jet plane, over and over and over. I'd left on a jet plane more times than Mr. Denver ever had himself, and I'd knocked on heaven's door so many times it had come off its hinges. Why I'd really been inspired to acquire the thing was to pen a deeply felt poetic gem to give the likes of Suzanne Vega's Luca a run for its money. Although, so far, all I'd managed to create was the improvised, off-the-cuff, one-dimensional mock country singer-songwriter Mickey Guitar Edwards II, and his latest ditty about some blackbird or another. When I played the evidence back to my family later on, they fell about in heaps of sniggering belly laughs, though I never really knew if they were laughing at my creation or at me. I do think it revealed another side of my personality to the normal moody teenager hiding away in his bedroom listening to obscure songwriters from across the pond. I've had cause lately to reminisce about my early days. For starters, today's television seems to have a constant fascination with the 1970s and 80s. From programmes about the birth of the microcomputer to BBC4 music compilations such as Singer-Songwriters at the BBC featuring the likes of Elton John, James Taylor, Cat Stevens, Jackson Browne and Neil Diamond. In fact, I think BBC4 should alter its continuity announcements to those of a star more fitting to those heady days and go the whole hog. By the way, it is possible to go onto YouTube now and endlessly watch old continuity from the BBC to your heart's content. Have a hankering to know what's on BBC Two on the evening of the 21st of October 1980? No problem. Just rack up to YouTube and away you go. And for those wondering, we were served up, among other things, a new chat show with the comforting Russell Harty, offbeat humour from the American comedian Kelly Monteith, and a rather thought-provoking edition of Man Alive with Nick Ross, who asked, "How angry and distressed have you felt by what you have seen on television?" as he and others investigated whether some TV shows should have been scrapped before they were ever made. To be honest, I can think of quite a few lately that have offended and frustrated me, but I digress, that's another story. It does seem that with channels such as Talking Pictures TV, UK TV Play and BritBox, we seem to have an ongoing obsession with looking back. Or maybe they just don't make them like they used to. it may also have something to do with us trying to relive those long-lost days, when we were more sprightly, lived life to the max and had all those whom we loved around us. I think TV has become such a rich and emotive part of our lives that our memories are now formed around the things we watch. Sometimes it may be comforting to watch something that we remember our younger selves watching with our parents or other long-lost relatives and friends. In a way, it serves to reignite those memories of perhaps happier times. This has certainly been the case for me, and it's also interesting to go back and watch something you remember for being particularly good and see if it stands the test of time. For instance, when I wrote the first draft of this piece back in 2010, the BBC were repeating the seminal gritty 80s drama Boys from the Black Stuff by Alan Bleasdale. I was just 13 years old when this bleak portrait of recession and unemployment hit TV screens. My priorities were a little different back then, but I remember how powerful that series was to an impressionable young teenager who, in a few short years, would be facing the heady world of unemployment himself. And, perhaps more importantly than that, I remember watching the series alongside my parents on the sofa. Because back then, in the days before the internet, streaming, broadband, and in some cases video recorders, watching TV programmes was a family event. There was something very comforting about relaxing in front of the rented box of valves and tubes in the corner for the evening, having personally negotiated another day at the prison that pretended to be a school, with the night's viewing carved up between just four channels. Looking back through the rose-tinted amalgamation of those memories to those days of long snowy winters, school cross-country runs, swap shop, Tiswas, the almost religious practice on Thursday night of Top of the Pops with the obligatory commentary from Dad, "What the bloody hell does he look like? Is that a man or a woman? You call that music?" Gazing at the top 40 singles in Woolworths and wondering which one to buy, racing downstairs totally naked on a winter's morn so I could get in front of the gas fire and warm my school clothes before getting dressed, watching the pre-6pm news kids animation, usually Paddington or maybe Will o' the Wisp, or the post-news BBC Two made-for-TV movie about the kid who gets lost in the wilderness and nearly dies but is rescued by his dad who fights a bear single-handedly. There was Friday nights with WKRP in Cincinnati and later Cheers, Thunderbirds on a Sunday afternoon while sniffing out the smell of a roast from the kitchen, Kojak, Columbo and Starsky and Hutch on a Saturday night, the luxury of being allowed to stop up for some late night viewing which inevitably led to a loss of consciousness as I battled against oncoming sleep. With all that time spent in front of the Gogglebox, it's easy to see how much of a part that flickering image has played in the routing of specific times and places in our lives. It's been even more hypnotising watching scenes from programmes made when I was just a small boy that I'd never seen before. I can't help thinking, I wonder what I was doing when this was originally shown. Maybe my mum and dad watched the 1971 BBC Neil Diamond concert featuring the song I Am I Said, which in turn I watched in 2010 as part of the compilation Songwriters at the BBC. I was only my son's age when this first went out back then, 2 years old. The series is a compilation of clips from the 70s taken from shows such as Old Grey Whistle Test, Top of the Pops and various one-off specials and concerts showcasing artists from the era. I've found some of the artists quite appealing, now being a man in my 40s with a wide appreciation of the craft of song. But back in the day, from a young shy toddler onwards, I would have had more interest in doodling with my Etch-a-Sketch, pushing toy cars around, or sending Action Man on a secret mission to scale the upper regions of the staircase. Half of the appeal of watching these performances recently is the allure of recapturing the memories of that time and using them as a tool to probe the lost part of my youth that has dwindled into the hazy fog of time. It kind of works too. There are flashes of scenes long lost which find their way to the fore as I watch Cat Stevens perform Wild World or Ralph McTell sing Streets of London. Were these tunes the soundtrack as I pushed a convoy of buses, trucks and lorries around the skirting board of our living room as I dressed Action Man in his winter warmers before a heady descent down the staircase? Or maybe as I tried to write my name for the zillionth time with the Etch-a-Sketch? I don't know. but taking in the oral and visual cues of those televisual recordings brings on a dreamlike quality in me. It was a time of badly judged tank tops, hideously huge collars that flapped in the wind, ill-fitting second-hand bell-bottom trousers, complete with holes in the pockets, and of shoes where every scuff mark told the story of a fall, climb, or just the dragging of my heels to and fro another day at junior school, which was only three houses away from home, but felt like crossing a desert to another land. There always seemed to be a tune in the wind and a moving image on that little box that sat in the corner. Buddy Holly was long dead but alive inside the glow of valves of our old wooden radiogram singing Peggy Sue. Neil Diamond's deep baritone serenaded Sweet Caroline. Neil Sedaka crooned O Carol, and Gene Pitney always found himself 24 hours from Tulsa, never seemingly to quite get there, the poor guy. The house was alive with the sound of music when Mum played the soundtrack to the film, and we had our fair share of Elgar's pomp and circumstance marching through from an LP of last night favourites. I'd like to think that this list of music's finest also included the likes of Pink Floyd, Jackson Browne, Ricky Lee Jones, James Taylor, or Loudon Rainwhite III, but my folks were not that adventurous when it came to music. They were children of the 50s, the three-minute toe-tapping chart hits of the rock and roll era, and although they appreciated a good ditty, they didn't seem quite so bothered about the scan of a lyric, the meter, or melodic line of a song. They just wanted a catchy tune and a good beat, which, to be honest, is fair enough. My parents didn't buy that much vinyl. Instead, we went through the weekly ritual of having to be deadly quiet while Dad recorded songs from the hit parade using one of those old cassette recorders. The microphone was so hypersensitive that unless its placement was just right, you would be in danger of hearing Mum in the background muttering something about forgetting to buy Brillo pads from SuperSave. This was the birth of home taping. Dad was at the forefront of this new technology, and at any point I expected the team from TV's Tomorrow's World to knock on our front door demanding an exclusive. I expect many homes went through the same Sunday afternoon routine, and that there are many cassettes lying in skips, attics, car boot sales and charity shops of dads who had poorly judged the distance between the wireless and the microphone and managed to get the drone of the washing machine going full pelt in the background, or the budgie inanely tweeting away to Shawaddy Waddy's Three Steps to Heaven. Dad tried to gag our budgie many times over the years. He tried everything to shut the little blighter up, putting a sheet over its cage, giving it extra seed to chomp on. But in the end, he may have just resorted to sticking the thing outside. But I may be just misremembering that. It's hard to think we only had three channels back then, but the content of the programming somehow made up for it. The Sweeney, Porridge, Dad's Army, Steptoe and Son, The Good Life, Life on Earth, Blake 7, Star Trek, Grange Hill, The Clangers, Pipkins, The Wombles, Danger Mouse, Jamie and the Magic Torch, Minder, Only Fools and Horses, to name but a few, were all enjoyed by this young lad. I was absolutely fascinated by Johnny Ball's Think of a Number, and absolutely bored rigid by Granada TV's investigative series World in Action. The opening titles alone put the willies right up me, with that spooky staccato organ theme tune and the endless images of panic, fear, death, destruction and war. Its placing on the schedule was just after the watershed and close to my bedtime, so I'd go off to the land of Nod with those pictures going round in my head. Tales from the Unexpected was another one that put me on edge, and often sent me to bed with strange dreams about human baby bees feeding on royal jelly, or psychopathic landladies who poisoned and stuffed their victims in order to keep them as keepsakes forever. One series that really left an impression on my young mind was Thames TV's version of Quatermass from 1979. Being just 10 at the time, my imagination was fired in all directions by this wonderful gem of a miniseries starring John Mills in the lead role. It really tapped into the whole hippie vibe of the 60s as groups of young people were strangely swept up in the cult-like planet people who roamed the countryside spaced out by some kind of alien energy. They were then eventually led to some sacred prehistoric site, maybe Stonehenge, where they were mysteriously harvested. All the ingredients of the plot, the trance-like state, the cult followers, ancestral stone circles, and an unearthly force coupled with the 9 p.m. broadcast time, meant that I would have been in that strange pre-sleep state and more susceptible to the themes as my mind became dreamlike. I believe this is why the series had a particular hold over me. It's not that it was stunningly good. Critics were not impressed with it, in fact. It's that it caught my developing imagination just at the right moment. Another miniseries which had a similar effect on me was the 1980 adaptation of the Ray Bradbury classic The Martian Chronicles, starring Rock Hudson. It was aired in the UK over 3 successive Saturday nights in August that year. Back then, my parents would probably have been out on a Saturday night, so I would have been left home alone. I don't think even I watched the whole thing, but I do remember glimpses of scenes involving the Martians which really unnerved me at the time. It was something to do with the barren but beautiful landscape of Mars that the series recreates, the eerie otherworldly score by Stanley Myers, or just the potato-headed appearance of the Martians who seem to be always skulking around in the background. Admittingly, this is one I intend to revisit when I have the chance, but suffice to say, for a boy of 11 in a house on his own in the dark, it was atmospheric enough to make me check under the bed for one of those pesky Martians before sleep. I do know that at some point on one of those Saturday evenings, just as it was getting dark, I was hurtling down our road on my bike, so I must have been up to no good with the local neighbourhood kids before getting to the TV to turn on the sci-fi action. Why such a memory should stay in my head, I don't know, and this is why I think it may have something to do with the specifically striking images that put a place marker, so to speak, in our memory so that they are easily recallable. Doctor Who, of course, made a huge impression on me during the 70s. Blimey, those opening titles alone would have put me into an altered state. I remember actually crying and hiding from watching it because I was so horrified by what was on the screen some weeks. One serial that particularly stands out as scaring the willies out of me was John Pertwee's last story, Planet of the Spiders, from 1974. This very story alone could well have been responsible for my irrational phobia of spiders. Yes, I know now that the things were just models, but to a 5-year-old they would have been human-eating monsters. The fact that Sarah Jane Smith was walking about with one of those giant 8-legged creatures on her back without knowing would have sent my mum into a screaming fit and me following closely behind her. And then there was everything else, including period pieces like Poldark, Little House on the Prairie, The Waltons and The Oneidian Line, etc. These did little for me and were just something I had to endure because my parents were watching them. When we finally got a 4th TV channel in 1982, we were treated to the likes of The Tube and The Comic Strip, which hailed the golden period of alternative comedy with such shows as The Young Ones, Friday and later Saturday Night Live. We certainly needed the new VHS video recorder, which had conveniently popped up beside the TV to record the explosion of comedy that was to follow. It was a huge brick of a thing. A top loader, which, when you hit the eject button, shot up like something out of one of those 70s sci-fi films about robots taking over the world. It took me 2 weeks to learn how to set the timer to record something, and even then, there were many painful mistakes that almost divided the family unit straight down the middle. Many times I was tasked to set the recorder by one of my parents to record a favourite film or TV series, but when they'd later settled down to watch it, they'd inevitably find I'd bundled the setting to the wrong time or channel, meaning that instead of the epic western or late night horror, they'd get an episode of The Open University about the ins and outs of programming a Commodore PET computer, or worse still, 90 minutes of snow in the form of static. Let's not forget that in the early 80s, kids were obsessed with those newfangled microcomputers that had just been released into the world. Spotty teenagers across the land, including myself, were waking up on Christmas morning 1983 to behold a box that contained the iconic Spectrum 48K. We thought we could program the thing to do anything we wanted. We thought it knew everything there was to know. I can still remember the smell of the polystyrene housing to this day, and the first of many attempts that morning to load the handful of games I'd also received with it, failing miserably. Eventually, several attempts later, I was playing Pac-Man, Space Invaders, and the annoyingly addictive Manic Miner. A whole new world had opened up, and with it came TV shows that tried to capture a new audience. The BBC offered a range of programmes stemming from its computer literacy project. One of the first was a series called Making the Most of the Micro, which tried to inform and educate the viewer to the possibilities of home computing by not just focusing on games but other uses. Later came the computer programme and Micro Live, which also conveniently provided a showcase for the BBC's own microcomputer. Most of these programmes were anchored by Ian McNaught Davis, who was already into his 50s when the show went out. He was ably assisted by Fred Harris, formerly presenter of early years TV favourite Play School, and Leslie Judd, Blue Peter's blonde adventurer in the 70s. The problem with this lineup was that the microcomputer explosion was happening to the next generation, the kids, not their parents, which meant that watching one of these shows was like listening to your mum or dad tell you these things are good for educational use, but don't be playing games on them and messing around. In 1984, Thames TV provided Database as a response to the BBC's efforts, hosted by Tony Bastable from Kids TV Magpie. The show had a similar philosophy, but with an added attraction. Every week, over the end credits, there would be a broadcast of software that viewers could record and load into their computers. I know that I got quite excited about this possibility and would have tried to record the Spectrum software transmission, but I have no memory of what the results were, which leads me to think that it probably didn't work, which, given the success of loading any game into the Spectrum, would have made sense. But I'd still be interested in what that software data dump actually contained. Maybe a self-destruct instruction or some such, but I can't find any information about it on the net at all. One of the interesting aspects of revisiting this nostalgia trip down memory lane, the first draft of which was written back in 2010, was in respect to the nastiness we have had to endure in the last few years. During the lockdown of 2020, many have confessed that they felt so low and despondent that they turned to that which had given them great joy and comfort as children. Inevitably, for many, this meant dusting off old books, CDs, DVDs, or even VHSs to watch the shows and films they remember enjoying as kids. For instance, due to the re-emergence of ITV's version of All Creatures Great and Small, I found that watching the old BBC series, which started in 1978 and ran throughout my childhood, quite cathartic and warming. A bit like putting on an old jumper or a pair of slippers. With this kind of TV show, you know you're in safe hands, that nothing overly bad is going to happen, and if it does, you know it'll all work out in the end. I think a lot of the allure of re-experiencing these shows, though, has to do with the circumstances in which you originally watched them. Back then, I remember All Creatures was one of those shows that all ages could appreciate, in the bosom of the family, so to speak. I think it's that sense of family viewing that really cements the memories in the old noggin for future reference. It's that shared experience that we are so lacking today. And I wonder if our kids somewhere down the line will find the same solace in the online streaming experience they have had at their fingertips. Which is why, where possible, I've sought to make sure that when possible my own family sits down together to watch things we can all enjoy. Back in that fateful year of 1982, there I turned into a teenager and shunned society in favour of life of bedroom solitude, a series called Boys from the Black Stuff burst into our TV screens. Bleasdale used characters from his 1980 BBC Two play for today called The Black Stuff for his five-part series set in Liverpool. It revolved around a group of unemployed men trying to get by in the dark days of Thatcher's Britain. It didn't pull any punches. Bleasdale's characters were desperate, lonely, angry people trying to get by when the world was seemingly falling to the ground around them. It was painfully true to life, expertly using the juxtaposition between humour and drama to release the tension of some pretty dark places the characters found themselves in. For instance, the scene in which despondent Yozza seeks help from a local priest by visiting a confessional box. "Call me Dan," says the priest, to which Yozza replies the immortal line, "I'm desperate, Dan." Such was the success of the series that it was repeated just 9 weeks after its first transmission. Not only that, but it gave birth to the catchphrase, "Gives a job," which entered society and was taken up by a generation of the unemployed, myself being counted among them when I left school 2 years later. Watching the series back again in October 2010, I tapped into that place where memories of myself as a boy exist. I don't know quite what I thought back then. I know I probably laughed along and felt sad and angry for the characters. I also know that those memories from watching entered my head and came out several years later when I strummed that G chord and sang, "If I was a blackbird." I didn't realise until watching one of the final scenes of the series finale, George's Last Ride, set in the totally run-down Green Man pub, where utter chaos breaks out as members of a wake and a redundancy party with nothing better to do collide in an orgy of drunkenness in order to forget about the realities that life has dealt them. The landlord fights a losing battle to keep the bar from erupting into havoc, helping himself to one drink after another as he tries to cope. It's a beautifully executed surreal scene that flits from one character to the next. A bouncer, who has been made unemployed, wanders from person to person, challenging them to shake hands, and then proceeds to squeeze their hands so tightly that they scream with agony. When the pale, expressionless face of Yozza Hughes enters the bar and is also similarly challenged, we know how things are going to play out. He's recently lost everything due to unemployment, even his kids, stolen by the state. As he stands motionless while Shake Hands tries to break his fingers, he feels no pain. He's already numb from the emotional pain he's endured. Suddenly, he lunges forward and headbutts the old bouncer, who collapses onto the floor in a heap. In among the disorder, we also get glimpses of another man, Ronnie, dressed in evening attire, suit and a bow tie, a waiter who has also fallen victim of Thatcher's Britain, a man who took the only thing he could when he lost his job, his uniform. Who knows what's going through his head, but his coping mechanism seems to be singing old tunes and impersonating birdcore, as throughout we hear his high-pitched vibrato serenading, "If I was a blackbird, I'd whistle and sing," before sticking three fingers into his mouth in order to impersonate bird calls. I've since found out that this is a traditional song covered by many entertainers over the years, and even reinvented by one I'd invented myself. So, now I know the origin of my madness in front of that video camera some 4 years later. Or was it? Well, there's a good chance, but I suppose I'll never really know. One thing is for certain. I'm sure going to be watching my own boy very closely as he starts widening his own teenage viewing habits in the coming years.